This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Andrew Miller, staff writer for the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Joel Hilliker is busily preparing the August edition of our print magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet, so I'll be subbing in as your host for this week's program. Thank you for joining us, and welcome to The Trumpet Hour. If you haven't subscribed to our print magazine, you can do so online at thetrumpet.com. The cost of subscription is free, paid for by the membership of the Philadelphia Church of God. I was actually reviewing over some of the upcoming articles this morning, and it just really looks like a really powerful issue this month, with topics ranging from ancient history to Christian living to geopolitics to current events. And speaking of current events, our panel of writers is here with me in the studio, eager and ready to discuss the most important news topics from this week. I have with me here Jeremiah Jacques.
Pleasure to be here. I'll be talking about Chinese velvet, its soft power, and how it's increasingly trying to use this power to promote its controversial territorial claims.
And via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, I have with me Brent Nachtigall.
Hello, thanks for having me. I'm going to be talking about some recent developments in the Syrian civil war, as well as an outbreak of violence between Ethiopia and Eritrea.
And via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon. We've talked a few times on this program about the economic empire China is building, and it sounds like we'll be hearing a bit more about that from Jeremiah. Well, I'll be talking about how Germany wants to join in.
And also via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Sam Livingston.
Hello, happy to be here. I will be talking about another issue that Barack Obama and Donald Trump agree on, that is that they've both put forward new proposals that no one on an official government terror watch list should be able to buy a gun. I'll be talking about that more later.
We'll certainly look forward to that. It doesn't seem like there's too many issues that you can find those two figures to agree on, so it should be interesting. On this show, we do really try to give a broad overview of all the important events from around the world. The Trumpet is based in the United States, but we obviously have staff in the United Kingdom, in Jerusalem, and also in Australia. Our staff watches every corner and assembles the best, most prophetic news. In today's show, though, we're going to be putting special emphasis on the role of the family and the fate of nations. It's been said that families are just nations grown great. And in a lot of ways, the difference between leading a family and leading a nation is only a difference of scale. This Sunday is Father's Day, both here in America and in Britain and in many other nations around the world. Yet, sadly, we're seeing major effects from fatherlessness on civil society. And so to tell us more about these effects, we're going to be turning to our American in Britain, Sam.
Thank you, Andrew. Like you said, this Sunday will be Father's Day. Sadly, though, there are about 25 million children in the United States where the meaning of this day really doesn't mean too much to them. About 25 million American children now grow up in households that are single-parent households just by the mother, so they're not living in a home with a married mom and dad. This is from an article on The Examiner. This is by Carol Josel. She noted that about 88% of the baby boomer generation grew up with two biological parents who were married to each other. And now today, that number has dwindled down to 68% and is continuing to move downward. So it's a 20% decrease just over a generation.
It's a major change.
And like I said, it's continuing to go down as well. She writes in this article, this is Carol Josel, she says, "Fatherlessness is now said to be the biggest family and social problem we face today. Indeed, fathers.com goes so far as to say that if we were to classify it as a disease, fatherlessness would be an epidemic worthy of attention as a national emergency." Now, you just imagine 25 million American children, if this was something like Ebola or Zika or some other disease, it's not something that you just turn a blind eye to. But really, you don't hear a lot about fatherlessness, and it is a thread that is seen and is really woven through a lot of the problems that we experience in the United States. She goes on to give the numbers about you know, what demographics suffer the worst from fatherlessness. Black children, 57.6% grew up in a home without a father, 30% of Hispanic children, and 21% of white children. And when I was researching for this, I came across a map from the Washington Post, and it basically surveyed different areas throughout the United States where fatherlessness is most prominent. It shouldn't come as a surprise that where the rates of fatherlessness were highest were in a lot of the inner cities, where crime rates are also highest. And I'm confident you could just take a map of where there's a lot of violence and murder rates, and that would lay right over the map of where you have the highest levels of fatherlessness. So there is a connection here. And like I said, it is an epidemic that doesn't get a lot of attention.
Right. I think I've seen a couple statistics that I don't have the exact number, but I think it's like something like close to almost 100% of gang members come from fatherless homes. And even of the another big topic in the news this week is mass shootings in America. We'll talk more about that later. But of the 33 mass shootings that have taken place in the Obama administration, almost all of them also came from fatherless homes, and the few exceptions to that were radical Islamist shooters who were raised by a radical Islamic father.
Yeah, and that again is something that you don't hear a lot about. You used to hear more about, well, when these mentally deranged shooters would go into somewhere like Sandy Hook or what happened in Los Angeles a few years ago, a lot of these college campuses, you used to hear a lot about, well, what was their background? Talk about they played violent video games or they were into drugs. But in most cases, a lot of these shooters, they did not have a father. And that really is underreported. And it's something that you see with a lot of problems that are plaguing the United States. This is from a columnist named Phyllis Schlafly. She wrote this back in 2005. She says, most of our social problems are caused by kids who grow up in homes without their own fathers. Drug abuse, illicit sexual activity, unwed pregnancies, youth suicide, high school dropouts, runaways, and crime, and the list goes on. And you take all of these scenarios, and it really is fascinating when you think, I'm just going to put a working man in this household and how much that solves. But again, that is an underreported trend that is really plaguing most of the United States.
It's amazing just how many of these society problems, just if you trace them back far enough, they all just really get back down to the breakdown of the family. I'd seen another report by Mother Jones that I'd reported, mentioned earlier, that mass shootings in the United States have actually increased 300% since in the last 5 years. And driven primarily by a breakdown of civil society caused by fatherlessness and radical Islam secondarily, but actually most of the shootings have been caused by like mentally unstable people from broken fatherless homes. But such tragedies, sadly, aren't even limited just to the United States. Violence and shootings, they're becoming more common in Britain as well. And so to inform us about a tragic murder that took place in Britain just a few days ago, we'll turn to Richard.
Yes, yesterday afternoon, Joe Cox, a member of parliament, an elected representative of the British people, she was stabbed and then shot. I believe it was outside where she was going to hold surgery, which is where the MPs meet members of the public and anyone can come up and raise any concerns that they have. She died from those wounds. She was a mother of two young children. She had a husband. She was a Labour MP, and it's the first member of parliament to be killed in office, I think, since the early 90s, and back when Irish terrorists were going around trying to kill parliamentarians and members of the royal family. It's not clear right now why she was killed. We do know that the shooter definitely had mental health problems, but they've not really been given any information so far as to what his motivations were. There was some talk at first about it being political. Then some of that news looked like that might have been an error or was being downplayed. The shooter's neighbors have said that he wasn't political at all. So as to motive, we're pretty much completely in the dark right now. Now, having said that, there's definitely a sense of shock over here, and there is a sense that this is because or this is connected to the kind of hate-filled rhetoric that is proliferating in British culture. And rightly or wrongly, the shooting has started a discussion about that. And there is a lot of extreme rhetoric. We see it in the UK. We see it in the US as well. You know, you have people on the left who genuinely believe that Mr. Cameron and the Conservatives are kind of the epitome of all evil and that they're only in power because they want to make poor people's lives utterly miserable. I've also been to debates and meetings on EU membership, and you know, I've seen that there is real hatred on the other side as well. There's real hatred on both sides of the debate and anger, and there is a sense of shock and then a sense that this has to stop.
Yeah, it just seems like it's just escalating across both nations. We definitely see that here in America, especially at this presidential campaign's just been shocking. At like these, you get these rallies for Donald Trump where you get the same, where you've got those who oppose him who think he's like the second coming of Adolf Hitler, and those who are for him who think he's like a savior to this nation. And it's just instead of getting just civilized political discourse, it's just getting like throwing rocks and burning cars and things like that as well. So it will we'll definitely have to keep an eye on that story in Britain to see if there's some common roots to what actually would cause someone to do this.
Yeah, and then of course the big thing hanging over all of this is the Brexit vote on Thursday next week, which, you know, emotions are running high over that. As someone has pointed out, this is, you know, referendums do generate much stronger feeling than elections because there's no, you know, we can't go back in 4 years' time and change our minds on this. And I do think it's sad that there is like one side of the debate, the in crowd, have tried to kind of paint the outers as if they're the only ones with some of this extreme rhetoric and put all the blame on them. But it is going to have an impact on that vote next week. All campaigning was shut down yesterday. It's shut down today. There's pretty much been silence on that. I wouldn't expect the campaigning to start up again probably until after Parliament has reconvened on Monday to pay tribute to Mrs. Cox. And so there's also, you know, we've got the referendum is next Thursday, and it looks like it is going to have an impact on that as well.
Yeah, it'll be another big story. I'm sure it'll get a lot of coverage here on our program. Thank you for bringing that to us, Richard. You've been listening to the Trump Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Shifting gears here a little bit, while America and Britain are struggling with this violence and civil unrest, other world powers are becoming more aggressive. The Trump staff has been watching China for some time now, and its moves to towards regional dominance over the trade routes and the nations of Southeast Asia. And so to give us a little more information on this, what he terms Chinese velvet, we'll turn to our primary Asian affairs news analyst, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, we speak often on the Trumpet Hour about what you might call China's steel, its hard military power, its brute force. But China also has a soft side. It has its velvet side, which international relations experts call soft power. And the news this week is that at the same time as we see the Chinese leadership ramping up its use of that hard military power, it's also intensifying its use of soft power. And it's doing so specifically to win hearts and minds around the globe to siding with China in its various territorial claims. In recent years, China has built more than 500 Confucius Institutes in countries all around the world, and the aim of these institutes is to teach people in those nations Mandarin and Cantonese and other Chinese languages, and also to promote what Beijing views as China's cultural superiority. This idea of China viewing itself as a superior culture is a really significant one that doesn't get that much attention in the Western press, but it's actually evident even if you just look at the name that Chinese people call China, which is Zonggao. Most analysts say Zonggao translates to Middle Kingdom, which sounds sort of Tolkienian to our Western ears. But the better translation of it would actually be Central Kingdom. The Chinese call their civilization the Central Kingdom because they view it as superior to any other people or civilization. I've got a quote here from Cornell University professor Jin Chen explaining this. He writes, "I believe that Central Kingdom is a more accurate translation for Zonggao because it implies that China is superior to any other people and a nation under the heavens, and that it thus occupies a central position in the known universe. So that sounds a little abstract and metaphysical maybe, but it's important because when we talk about American exceptionalism and the debate that's raging right now about whether or not that's a true thing, it's important to know that China views itself as an exceptional nation. And not just that, but actually as a superior nation. They're a 5,000-year-old civilization, and they have this sincere feeling of being kind of an example nation. And as you said in the introduction there, the rightful hegemon of the Asian region. And so these Confucius centers and China's other soft power pushes are designed to try to win the hearts and minds of people around the world over to seeing China as this superior central kingdom, the way Chinese people, for the most part, seem to view themselves. And all big powers really engage in public relations and soft power campaigns, but the scale of Beijing's push is unprecedented and unmatched. Each year, China spends about $10 billion on soft power pushing, which you could call external propaganda. And you can compare that to the United States, which spends about $600 million on public diplomacy. So that's, you know, less than one-tenth of China's
amount. Yeah, a fascinating discrepancy, I guess. I hadn't heard of some of this until you told me about it earlier, but it's it just seems fascinating. Just coming to my mind right now, it almost sounds very similar to a Russian strategy, where I know Vladimir Putin's relied a lot on Russian Orthodox priests that he'll send to Ukraine or to Belarus or to Kazakhstan to try to provide like an ideological sense of unity for his new Eurasian Union. And I guess you'd say that China's kind of having a similar strategy, but just using the Confucianist philosophy.
Yeah, that's right. And then earlier this month, China began extending its soft power propaganda tentacles into independent Western media. There's a publication called the China Daily that's one of the Communist Party's mouthpieces, and it started producing a monthly pullout called China Watch. It's a pullout of articles that basically just backs all of China's, you know, island building and military buildup there in the South China Sea and other moves toward asserting its power. And this pullout now appears in such bastions of free speech as the Sydney Morning Herald, the Washington Post in the U.S., the Daily Telegram in the U.K., Le Figaro there in France. And it's surprising to me that these Western publications would allow themselves to be bought by such obvious and shameless propaganda. But the industry of journalism is suffering around the world, so it makes these publications more likely to accept Beijing's money in exchange for printing this China Watch pullout that really just, you know, promotes Chinese interests.
Right, yeah, just a fascinating trend to watch. Again, another thing that just brings Russia to mind, using state-run media to try to run propaganda campaigns in Western markets, same as China.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And even though these campaigns are slow, they are apparently paying some small dividends. And China seems okay with that, even though it's only gradually winning over those hearts and minds. And this mentality behind this push reminds me of the words of China's most famous philosopher, Confucius. He said, "It does not matter how slowly you go, so long as you don't stop."
Yeah, there's quite a bit of wisdom in that statement. Definitely, thanks for bringing those to us. You've been listening to the Trumpet Hour, and now we've talked much about China. This is a militarizing of sea gates in the past, but there's another vital sea gate in the Middle East that's under threat in a country that most people probably haven't even heard of, Eritrea. But to tell us a little bit more about Eritrea and why we should know more about it, we'll turn to our Middle East correspondent, Brent.
Right. So Eritrea, even as we were discussing before, is kind of a little bit south of the Middle East, but Bible prophecy definitely puts it in the Middle Eastern sphere. This past week, there was a violent flare-up, between Eritrea and Ethiopia. Eritrea won independence from Ethiopia back in 1991. So it was, before that point, it was part of Ethiopia, and there was a 30-year-long war between the two areas. But now, ever since they have broken off, there has been attacks, but border skirmishes, if you like, between the two sides every so often. Yet this latest one that took place this week looks to be the most violent since the border war of 1998 to 2000. So the worst violence that's taken place in about 15 years. Now, each country blamed the other for starting it. It involved a number of bits of artillery fire across each border following the initial confrontation. Whatever caused that, we're not really sure. Eritrea is one of those places that you don't hear much about because they have horrible freedom of the press. It's ranked behind North Korea on the freedom of the press scale, I guess, something that's been put out.
It's an accomplishment.
It's put out every year, and it came last for 6 years running. So we don't hear much press from Eritrea, but like you said at the beginning, it is an important place just because of the geographic location it finds itself in.
Right, yeah, it's right there on the Straits of Bab el-Mandeb. I don't have statistics, but I know it's right there along the Red Sea trade route, connected up to the Suez Canal. So, I mean, just a tremendous amount of world trade goes through there. And from my understanding, unlike Ethiopia, Eritrea is a majority Islamic nation with pretty close ties to Iran.
Yeah, it's about 50-50. Half of it is Islamic. Depends on who you follow, whether it's the World Factbook, the CIA, or depends, because, as I said, Eritrea doesn't really release too many statistics, so it's hard to tell. But they are certainly more Islamic-leaning than Ethiopia. And as you said, it is right on the southern portion of the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. And we've talked a lot on this program about Yemen, which does occupy the other side of that strait. It's just 20 plus miles across there. And as Callum Wood brings out on the trumpet.com today, he's written an article about this that I really encourage people to read, because it talks about the geopolitical significance of this country and whether this latest flare-up could be a sign that instability is coming to that region. Between Ethiopia and Eritrea, Sudan, Egypt, we've talked about how Iran does desire, based on Bible prophecy, to control that. And they have a habit, Iran does, of capitalizing on situations like this where you have violence taking place in a country and maybe a weak government, as it does seem right now. The government in Eritrea is the weakest it's been in the past 25 years. And you can see that Iran would like to capitalize on that. As you said earlier, Iran does have a relationship with Eritrea. In 2009, as Callum Wood brings out in this article, as soon as the nuclear deal looked like it was being ramped up by the Iranians, pretty much the Eritrea came out and supported their right to nuclear power. And then Tehran, you know, sent them $35 million straight off the cuff for that. Then Tehran, they've worked close with Eritrea as well, trying to smuggle weapons into Somalia through using ports in Eritrea. And then as soon as Yemen's exiled government had to leave because of the Houthi rebels, the exiled government of Yemen, they said that the Eritreans were supporting the Iranians in this as well. So Iran does look like it is capitalizing on Eritrea's weakening government.
Definitely an important trend to keep an eye on. So I'm sure we'll be back in the future with more reports on Eritrea, and I guess all our listeners probably going to have to run and find their atlas and find out exactly where it is now. But you've been listening to the Trumpet Hour. We're coming to the end here of our first segment, but coming up after the break, we'll be talking about German cooperation with China, Russia's new hypersonic weapon, Afghan refugees joining the battle for Syria, and another hot topic on people's minds, gun control in America. We'll be back in a moment.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Hour. we're getting ready to get into our next segment of stories. And so leading into this, we'll start with the fact that actually the world's two biggest export-based economies are Germany and China. These two powerhouses dominate the economic scenes on their respective continents, Europe and Asia. And now to tell us some more reports on how these two powerhouses are actually starting to cooperate and work together, we'll turn to our man in Britain, Richard.
Yes, these two powers, economic powers, do have huge potential, either to be competitors against each other or working together to really influence the world. Now, China's kind of global economic colonization is well known. We've talked about that quite a few times on this program. It's buying up international resources at a huge rate. Since 2010, the state-owned China Development Bank and the Export-Import Bank of China, they've lent more money each year to developing countries than the World Bank has. Between 2004 and 2013, its overseas investment rose from $45 billion to over $600 billion. You've now got countries like Zimbabwe using the renminbi as its primary international currency. So their influence around the world is well known. And now Germany is looking like it wants to join in. German Chancellor Angela Merkel was in China this week. China and Germany hold regular joint cabinet meetings. That alone shows you a lot about their relationship. There aren't many countries that Germany does that with. Israel is another. It's not something they do with even many democracies, but they have a very close relationship with China. And while they were there, one of the key things they talked about was working together in some of these third countries. So basically Germany joining in with some of China's economic colonization. So Angela Merkel said, if we join forces and get active in markets such as Asia or Africa, we can all benefit from our combined strength.
Right, because China pretty much already dominates the Asian economy and Germany dominates the European economy. So if they can cooperate to start dominating like Africa and Latin America, that's like all the continents except for basically North America and Antarctica, but there's not much economic strength there.
Right. And so what they're doing is they're starting kind of in a fairly small way in Afghanistan. So they're setting up a bunch of joint projects. They're doing a joint coal mining project, joint disaster relief effort, and they're working together on university education there. And Deutsche Welle wrote, this may seem like a small step, but for China, a country that normally follows strict non-interference policies, it's a new direction. And so, China, they go into these countries, but it's all very, it's done with Chinese businesses. And so Germany wants to get in on that. Another example is Siemens. It's looking like they're going to work together with the China Railway Rolling Stock Cooperation. And so when China goes in and, they upgrade all the infrastructure in all these countries that they go in because they need to be able to ship the raw materials out to China. They need to get them to the coast, onto boats and into China. So Siemens is going to work there, maybe even Deutsche Bahn. And they would work together on freight transport and setting up transportation networks. So China wins there. They get Germany's help in setting up these transportation networks. Germany gets in on the business. And as you said, both are big economic export-based powerhouses of the economy, but the whole world is in a recession. Both are struggling to gain new export customers.
Well,
and so this is a way that they can try and work together to open up new businesses in different countries rather than working against each other.
Right. It certainly sounds like a deal like this could really benefit both China's economy and Germany's economy. And who knows, maybe even some of these third world economies, although generally where China is involved in third world countries, that they do tend to be fairly authoritarian and fairly oppressive. So even if they do end up benefiting some of those economies, I doubt much of that will trickle down to the common people. But I guess just the one concern that popped into my mind is that America's status as the world reserve currency is based on the fact that most global trade is denominated in dollars. And so if you start getting Germany and China, you mentioned them using China's currency for some of these trade transactions, that that looks like it could really end up being a major blow against the dollar standing as the world's reserve currency.
Right. I think that's something for down the line. They haven't talked about adopting or changing that right now. I think they're still doing their trade within dollars, but it's definitely potential. And I think one thing that just really shows the scale of their ambition here, and the fact it gives an indication that, you know, China's ambition will lead it in that direction to compete against the US, is one of the other things they talked a lot about and that we wrote about in this week's Trumpet Weekly is the new Silk Road. And that is a really ambitious project to dramatically expand the rail networks between China, going all the way up through Central Asia, through Russia and into Europe. Then also just networks of ports that take it kind of all the way along the coast from China to Europe. And to really increase the trade between Europe and China by increasing those transportation networks. And it's called the New Silk Road. Before the days of Columbus, you had the old Silk Road, and there was a very thriving trade route that followed exactly that, even to the point that, for example, Roman coins from the days of the Roman Empire have been found in eastern China. So there was a great deal of communication that happened along those networks. Columbus came along, you started to get the shipping took over, it revolutionized the way the world did business. And so by going back, or by looking at resurrecting the Silk Road, they're really looking at a completely different way of doing business, a way that cuts out the influence of the United States to kind of create this separate economic system where Germany and where Europe and China can trade directly without having to rely so much on the global shipping lanes. And so China is trying to set up the separate system. Germany is on board with that. And so Germany sees China setting up basically an alternative to the US dollar denominated system. And they say, we want to get in on that. We want to get on it early on, and we want to help China build this.
Right. It's just a fascinating and, a trend we need to be aware of. We've actually got an article coming up in our August issue of The Trumpet on the strategy China's had since 1949 to replace America as the world's global superpower within 33 years. It's really laid out and really hasn't been given much coverage in the Western press, so we included it in the next Trumpet. But it's one major thing to watch is China really can't do that as long as they're dependent on having to sell stuff to America. They need a new trade partner. And it looks like with these reports you've given to us that Europe may well be quickly becoming that new trade partner. So we definitely, thanks for the report. We'll keep an eye on that. And moving to another part of the world, despite Germany's recent efforts to woo the Chinese, it's well known that China's bestest friend in the whole wide world is Russia. And so to tell us a little bit more about a frightening new weapon Russia's developing, we'll go to Jeremiah.
Yeah, Russia is developing long-range, hypersonic, ultra-maneuverable, untrackable gliders. And these will allow it to penetrate any missile defense systems with its nuclear warheads, including the United States missile defense systems. So these gliders are not yet incorporated into the Russian arsenals. They're still in development, but they apparently harness some of the most sophisticated weapons technology ever developed, and it enables them to reach speeds up to Mach 10, which is some 7,600 miles per hour. And they're also ultra-maneuverable, even at these incredible speeds, and they're untrackable after that initial boost phase of their flight. So these are called the U-74 hypersonic glide vehicles, and from what I can tell, it's the combination of its speed and its ultra-maneuverability that makes these vehicles able to get Russian nuclear warheads past a wide range of missile defense systems. Although the system specifications are top secret, reports say that the gliders are developed to be loaded onto Russia's RS-28 Sarmat. And that's the state-of-the-art heavy liquid-propelled ICBMs. Those are currently being developed for the Russian army. So each Sarmat ballistic missile can carry up to 24 nuclear-loaded U-74 hypersonic gliders.
Richard, you had a comment.
Yeah, just to kind of clarify how these, or what's so special about these things, because China is also working and they've started testing on some of these hypersonic glide vehicles. What's unique is more their trajectory. Standard ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, they do travel faster than these hypersonic glide vehicles, but they're coming down from a very high altitude. So if you're trying to shoot them down, you can see them coming for a very long way. You've got lots of time to get everything lined up and shot at them to try and stop this missile. The hypersonic glide vehicles come in much more vertically, like almost flat when they're on their approach phase. And so instead of coming down on you, they're coming across. You've got just a blip as they come over your head and they're gone. Then they're maneuverable as well. And so that just makes them able to penetrate defenses. Russia wants to have theirs ready by 2020. The US is scheduled to begin testing a laser system that would intercept these in 2021. And that's to begin proof of concept testing. Right. So
like a dangerous 12 months in between.
Well, and they're looking at actually in terms of the U.S. defenses being operational in the 2030s. I've been trying to pull out the quote, but there was a deputy Russian prime minister who said that the successful invention of a hypersonic glide vehicle could be as big as the successful testing first testing of a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, well, I've got a report here from one analyst who he spoke on the condition of anonymity, a high-ranking Russian military official of some kind, but said that they've already successfully tested one of these U-74 gliders. It was apparently launched from the Dombarovsky missile base there toward the southwest of Russia's territory, and it hit a target in the Kura missile range, close to 2,000 miles away there in the Far East. So,
right. Yeah. It's just amazing how quickly some of these Asian nations are developing their military once they've got the natural resources and the economic strength already behind them. So, definitely thanks for the report, guys. A lot of stuff I didn't know. But shifting gears to another dangerous part of the world, in Syria is a very complicated place in Syria. Even I lose track often of the shifting alliances over there. You really need someone who keeps up with that because things change so quickly. But fortunately, we've got a news correspondent actually based in the Middle East in Jerusalem. So to give us a little bit more of a report on the shifting alliances and this Syrian civil war, we'll go to Brent.
Well, there was a lot of things that happened in this past week in the civil war in Syria, but then also the fight against the Islamic State. And I'd like to update everybody on just a few of those. Namely, just yesterday or even into today, it looks like the battle for Fallujah, one of the ISIS strongholds in Iraq, looks like it's going very successfully. And that's headed by the Iraqi security forces, backed up by a number of Shiite militias that Iran orders around. And it's got U.S. airstrikes providing the air cover as well for that. And it looks like Fallujah might be taken back away from ISIS. So there is a development there in Iraq. And yet what we see in the fight against ISIS in Syria is limited successes. But then a further complicating, as you even mentioned, of the alliances or the fighting groups that are in Syria. And the other two stories I want to focus on is one that indicated this week that there is a growing rift between Hezbollah, the Lebanese terrorist organization that's funded by Iran, that is over in Syria for the past few years, supporting the Syrian regime of al-Assad. It looks like there's some cracks between the Hezbollah and al-Assad's regime. On Thursday, fighting inside the southern suburbs of Aleppo, one of the main cities in Syria, main population centers in Syria, which has experienced some of the most horrific fighting. On Thursday, you had the Syrian Air Force actually have airstrikes against Hezbollah, because they were doing things that they didn't like. Now, this hasn't happened in the 5 years of the Syrian civil war. Hezbollah has always been supportive of the Syrian strongman, and yet it looks like there might be a shift there, or at least some animosity between those two groups.
And so, yeah, in some way it almost seems like Iran, which is the ones who control Hezbollah, seems almost like hedging its bets to now whether whether Assad wins or loses, they still have quite a bit of control into the next government.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. I feel like, I don't know if I would say that, because I feel like that without Assad in Syria, then they've lost the land bridge to support Hezbollah, so over in Lebanon. So if Iran is going to maintain control of Hezbollah, they probably need to maintain at least the regime in southern Syria, inside the area around Damascus, all the way up to Aleppo. But what you had just this week with the fighting between the two, the fighting allegedly broke out because Hezbollah was told to withdraw from an area where they had lost a lot of their fighters fighting against the Islamic State and fighting against the northern rebels that the United States is backing. And the Syrian government told them to withdraw, but they didn't want to withdraw because they'd fought so hard for this area and lost a lot of their men. So they wanted to stay, but then the Syrian government came and bombed them out of the place. A pro-Assad Syrian member of the parliament said this on Facebook. He said, "National sovereignty is a red line. Decisions must always be made by the Syrian army. Any controversy with the allied forces, that is Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, any controversy should be resolved as soon as possible because we are in a period where there is no room for arguments. My sons in Hezbollah, you came to Syria to support us, not dominate us. I am asking you to rethink your attitude." Now, this is big because for all effective purposes, the best militia or the best fighting force on the ground, boots on the ground in the Syrian civil war is Hezbollah. They are by far the most well-equipped and had a lot of practice against the Israelis, and they've had so many more victories than even the Syrian infantry. And they've been told by this, they've been governed by a more ineffective military force, and they're sick of losing their sons' lives. They're sick of being dominated by somebody that, for all intents and purposes, can't do a good of job as them.
So I'd seen in our Trumpet Weekly as well, that you said Iran may even bring in some Afghan fighters to help shore up support.
Right. There's a great article by Kieran Underwood, one of our younger writers over there in Edmonds. He wrote about how, and I really do suggest people read the article online. The Trumpet Weekly is great, and we always push it on this show. But if you want to get the full understanding, you need to read the full article. And he talks about how there are about 1 million undocumented Afghanis, Shiite Afghanis, that are in Syria, and how the Iranians are calling them up. They have about 20,000 men in this Afghani militia fighting in Syria, and they've put out a call for more Afghanis to join this. And it is another sign that Iran isn't really happy with the way things are going on in Syria. Yes, they're happy with Iraq. And the Shiite militias over there that they control are winning battles against ISIS, taking more territory away from we're going to dominate that territory once ISIS goes. But in Syria, it's a tougher fight, a much tougher fight. And we're seeing the alliance of Iran, Hezbollah, and even the Syrian regime, and even with Russia. It looks like there's some cracks in that alliance. And that, as we know, does fit in. It's a Bible prophecy of what we're looking for the future of Syria.
Right. It'd be, both Europe and it provides a tremendous opening for them to come in and try to form some deals with the new government if this alliance between Syria and Iran and Russia's got some cracks in it.
Yeah, and we are trying to look for some resolution in the Syrian civil war. It's been going on for 5 years. And ISIS is, even though that's on everybody's mind, ISIS is a newcomer in this war. The war was raging for 3 years before they got there. And now you just have the United States, Russia, Iran heavily invested, a lot of people invested. I don't know how you'd put Humpty Dumpty back together again. Right. At the conclusion of this, speaking of the Syrian state, whether it would come together under one government. But it does need something dramatic to take place. And what we're missing, and what Bible prophecy says will happen that is dramatic, is an intervention by Europe eventually. So we'll keep our eyes peeled for that.
Yeah, well, definitely. Thanks for keeping us up to date on those affairs. Moving to our next story, I was reading a quite profound quote this week by American founding father Benjamin Franklin, who claim that only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become corrupt and become vicious, they have more need of masters, which ties into what we were talking at the beginning with this family breakdown, this fatherlessness, this mental illness and stuff that's led to a 300% rise in mass shootings in just the 15 years is because Americans can't govern themselves like they were in past generations. It does seem like they're going to need masters or those in the federal government who will step in to protect us all. As we mentioned at the beginning, there's a plan being put forward that actually President Barack Obama and Donald J. Trump seem to agree with on gun control. And to give us a few of those details, we'll go to Sam.
Thank you, Andrew. You're exactly right about that quote. It is a very controversial issue, and I don't have the time to get into all the ins and outs of it. Talking about the Orlando massacre, it really didn't take long after that massacre for the politicians to start jumping on it. I think President Obama commented on gun control just a few hours after the attack occurred. And Mr. Flurry actually talked a lot about that on his Trumpet Daily show that's going up today. So I'd watch that, or I'd listen to that, definitely to get more about the politics of it. Currently, as it stands, obviously, we're hearing a lot more about this gun control being brought up with this issue. And right now, if you're a convicted felon in the United States, you cannot buy a firearm. And that's pretty much sweeping across the United States. Felons cannot buy a firearm. And now there's these new proposals coming forward that any person who is on the terror watch list should not be able to buy a gun. And Barack Obama has put that forward. And surprisingly, to many conservatives, Donald Trump has also jumped on board with that new proposal that anyone on a terror watch list should not be able to buy a gun. And initially, I thought, well, you'd think that's common sense. I thought, well, we would have done that long beforehand. If someone is suspected of terrorism, why should they be able to get a gun? And they propose a lot of these measures, and then they keep getting blocked in Congress. The Republicans don't want this. And I'm still here kind of looking at this myself. Why wouldn't you block, or why would you block something like that? Isn't that, as President Obama says, a common sense gun law? And when you look into it a little bit more, the terror watch list isn't exactly what you'd think it is. I was thinking, well, it's obviously these are people the government is investigating and they're terrorists. Don't let them have guns. It's very vague. Who decides who gets put on the terror watch list, how they get put on there, the facts and the evidence supporting who is put on that list. Currently, there's about 1.1 million people on that list, and 25,000 of them are U.S. citizens. And it's surprising, though, when you read through some of the cases where people are put on this list. There's one example of someone who stocked up on food for more than 7 days, and this was seen as a very right-wing extremist move, and they were put on this list. And the government doesn't have to notify you that you're on the list. There doesn't have to be a formal investigation. In 2013, just under 500,000 people were added to this list. So they're not investigating all of them, and there's no way to look into each and every case here.
Right. That is the catch-22 you get with this. Is the nice thing about the anti-felon law is a felon has to be convicted by a judge in the judiciary branch and tried by a jury of your peers. The American Constitution puts a lot of oversight and checks and balances on the judicial process. For a federal watch list, that's pretty much just put together by the FBI. And so whoever's the president staffing the FBI has a tremendous amount of control to decide who goes on this watch list. Is it going to be Islamist? Is it going to be people who just like to buy more food than what he thinks normal? Or is it going to be critics of whatever president's in power at the time? It's just it does get back what Benjamin Franklin says with that civil liberties case. Is like I said, if you give this government the power to protect you, they'll most likely abuse it. But if the people aren't if there's not enough moral fiber in the nation to prevent these mass shootings on their own, what choice do you have? There's really not much solution to something like this other than mass repentance and a return to morality that would have been a little more common in this nation in decades past. We definitely thank you bringing that forward to us. That's a topic we could talk on for quite a while, but we're just about out of time now. So you can find us online at thetrumpet.com and go there and receive a free subscription to our new weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All these stories we've been talking about are in there, and we'll finish the program with our lightning round of appointment news from all our panelists coming up next.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Time now for our lightning round. One last look at some of the important headlines from this week that caught our attention. And to start off, we'll go to Sam.
Police in a U.S. town near the Mexican border this week found an undocumented Islamic refugee, and she was in possession of pipeline plans. They weren't sure why she had those, but they figured that it might have been part of a plot to attack American infrastructure. It's just another example of Islamist refugees being smuggled across the U.S.-Mexican border.
Yeah, I don't even want to think about what she was going to do with those. But well, for next, we'll go to Richard.
The University of Leipzig published a survey with some pretty shocking results from Germany this week. They found that 1 in 10 Germans wanted to be led by a Führer or dictator. About the same number said that Jews have too much influence and that Germans are by nature more superior to other people. Perhaps more worrying, they found a much wider view of what views, a wider spectrum of views that are generally called Islamophobic. 4 in 10 thought that Muslims shouldn't come to the country. The report said they found a clear polarization and radicalization in German society. And related to that, this week also, Germany is cracking down on polygamy. Obviously a good thing. They're not going to tolerate Islamic polygamy anymore. It's quite bizarre that they were in the first place. But again, it shows a hardening of attitudes and a willingness to stand up to Islam within Germany.
And now to Brent.
There's a growing disagreement between the United States State Department and the Obama administration over the handling of the Syrian war. Dissent Channel Cable was signed by 51 State Department officers and released this week internally. And basically, it's a scathing rebuke of the Obama administration's policy to support Syrian strongman Bashar al-Assad, regardless of what he does, whether he's barrel bombing his people, his own people, or torture, what have you. The State Department is upset that their advice has not been heeded and that President Obama didn't follow through with his red line. And mainly, they're upset that he's not bombing Syria's Assad.
And now to Jeremiah.
U.S. President Barack Obama met with the exiled Tibetan spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, at the White House on Wednesday, and China is furious about the meeting. China considers the Dalai Lama a dangerous separatist, and the Chinese ministry spokesman said the meeting would encourage separatist forces there in Tibet. And then there was a commentary on China's official news agency, Xinhua, that said the meeting had, quote, seriously jeopardized China-U.S. relations and deeply hurt the Chinese people's feelings.
All right, and one last story from Sam.
Nigel Farage led a flotilla of about 30 boats up the River Thames on Wednesday to support the Leave campaign, the Brexit campaign there. As they were going up the river, he was met by other boats for the Remain camp. There was a lot of shouting. One of the boats had incredibly loud speakers. They were yelling. They were shooting water at each other. At one point, the police had to get involved there. But kind of a comical display of the increase in tension here as the Brexit vote approaches.
Only in Britain. All right. That concludes our lightning round. I'm Andrew Miller, and we're coming to the end of the Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. And again, all these stories are in this week's edition. You can tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, and Sam Livingston.
Great to be here.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. I'll leave you with the words of the late U.S. President Ronald Reagan. all great change in America begins at the dinner table. Thank you for joining us on the Trumpet Hour, and have a wonderful Father's Day weekend. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.